personal views and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are their own and are not legal advice or official statements by their organizations. Hello, my name is Debbie Reynolds. They call me the Data Diva. This is the Data Diva Talks Privacy Podcast, where we discuss data privacy issues with industry leaders around the world with information that businesses need to know now. I have a special guest on the show, Chris Glandon. He is the host of the Barcode Podcast, which is a really cool cybersecurity podcast. I've been a guest on your show. You're also a security strategist, founder, and advisor on things like cybercrime, innovation, leadership, and cybersecurity. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Debbie. It's an honor to be on your show. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah, this is great. This is great. So podcast hosts get to interview one another. So you put you in the hot seat for a change, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm sweating
oh,
already.
Oh my goodness. Well, you and I found each other on LinkedIn. I think we read each other's content. You invited me to be on your show a while back. Your show is very unique. You had a show before I had a show, actually a podcast. So you've been doing it for quite some time. You know, I love your show, first of all, because you really dig deep into issues. So I feel like some people do it on a surface level, right? Like kind of almost like, I don't know, like the BuzzFeed, you know, here are the five, you know, top tips that anybody can tell you. And you really go deep with your audience on different subjects. So you really do your research and you say things that I feel that are very actionable. Also, the concept of your podcast is cool. So every podcast episode, you have Tony the bartender. He creates like a drink for a drink named after the guest. And it's pretty cool. I've not seen anybody be as creative as you in this space. But tell me a little bit about yourself. Tell me about kind of your journey into, you know, technology and why you ended up deciding you want to do this podcast. Barcode.
Yeah, well, first off, thank you for the kind words. I really appreciate it. And Tony's not actually a real bartender, so I need to put that disclaimer out there. Tony is a friend of mine who works in a liquor store. So I guess that it's close, but he doesn't actually make drinks in real life outside of what I direct him to make. So, but he's definitely a unique character. So he adds some flavor to the show. For sure. But I mean, as far as my journey goes into security, so I came up through the IT sector. I got into IT in the late 90s. I worked at Comcast for a while. I went to work at JP Morgan Chase for a while. And I didn't graduate to security or really get into security and make that my career path till about 2011. So 2011, I ended up going to work for a very small bank as a level one security analyst. And a friend of mine actually brought me in because he had just taken over that group. He knew I was interested. And I just took advantage of it because I didn't think there was another way for me to get in at that time. I didn't have any formal training. I didn't even have any formal training in IT. I was self-taught pretty much throughout my entire career. So when he offered that up to me, he knew I had an interest there. So I went and I did security as a level one analyst at a bank. And 2 weeks in, they offered me to go down to Hacker Halted in Atlanta to do some training. And I was like, all right, well, what am I going to do at Hacker Halted? Like, that just sounds intimidating. What kind of classes do they have? And I looked at the classes and there was like an intro to cyber. So I said, all right, I'll take this intro to cyber course. And they called me back, said it got canceled. All we have left is the CEH course. I'm like, I don't even know what CEH stands for, but sign me up. So I went down there and, you know, I'm immersed with all of these security guys and ethical hackers. And they had the Cyber Olympics going on at the time. And it was just captivating for me coming from IT, but not knowing that side of things. So it really hooked me after I got there and actually got to talk to people and realize that security is more than technology. There's so many layers to security. And yeah, that's really what hooked me. So I've been in the security game ever since, worked my way through the ranks from analyst to engineer to architect. I've been doing consulting for the past 5 years now. And then in 2020, during the pandemic, I decided to launch Barcode, which is split barcode. So the atmosphere is like you're in a bar, and the code is essentially the open source code that experts like yourself, Debbie, come on and share with us. So I felt like it was filling a void at the time of the pandemic where folks couldn't get out to conferences like Hacker Halted, like Black Hat, DEF CON, and meet up at happy hours and have these, you know, off the cuff conversations or conversations that aren't in front of a, you know, a conference room. So that was really my mission, was to transplant that feel and that vibe into audio. And if you've heard the show, you know, I really try to paint that picture. Like I really try to take it back to radio, when radio was you could visualize things and you run with your imagination on things. So yeah, that's what keeps me going. And the reason I love it the most is I get to talk to people like you. I learn as I do it. It gives people a platform for others to hear their voice, and the listener also takes away something from it as well. So it's a win three ways, the way that I see it.
Well, you're definitely succeeding. I think some people, when they think about doing podcasting, they don't really know what they want to say. They just say, oh, you know, they think it's cool just to have a podcast, but it really, the best shows are the ones that are really thought out. Just like you said, like you had a purpose, you know, there was a void there. You wanted to make sure that your message is on point, even though you have different guests, you know, the overall arching goal is the same. So I think that's what makes your podcast so interesting. You said something interesting, and I love to dig in deep on this. So you said that security is not just technology, and I would love for you to talk a little bit about that, because I think people feel like the opposite. So people feel the opposite. And to me, in some ways, that's kind of an abdication of your human responsibility. So if you think a tool is going to like solve all of your problems, like you have much bigger problems. So tell me a little bit about your idea about security is not just technology.
Yeah, the way that I went into security was thinking that it was technical. And I didn't quite understand the different levels that came with that. And what I mean by that is that there's psychological levels to it. So you have the social engineering piece, you have physical aspects of it, and you have the physical intrusion piece to it. And there's a lot more that goes into it than just understanding how to sit behind a screen. I think, even when you're doing that, And I learned this going through the CEH in terms of like your reconnaissance steps and your initial foothold into a network. So even if you're doing behind the scenes, there's still steps involved that take creativity, I think, to be really good at it. So those are the things that I meant in terms of layers. Obviously, it's great to have that technical acumen, especially coming from IT. That helped. But once you get immersed into security, you realize that it goes way beyond the technical piece. So I think you have to be willing to learn these different aspects. If you're creative in nature, I think that also helps as well. Because as you can tell, when you're hacking, I think hacking or hackers have a particular mindset. It's a hacker mindset versus a role or a function. So it's just thinking differently. If you're creative, if you're an artist, you know, anything along those lines, you can apply that to the hacker mindset. So these are all things that I realized after I got into security.
Very good. Very good. I want your thoughts on insider threats. So I've done a couple of sessions, people ask me about insider threats. And I don't know about you, but my eyes start rolling when when someone says insider threats, and then they start talking about like the rogue employee, right? And so I saw a statistic recently that said that only, you know, of insider threats, like less than 30% are rogue employees. So if all you're thinking about is the rogue employee, you're missing like, you know, 70% of what an actual insider threat is. So tell me your thoughts about this whole insider threat shenanigans.
Yeah, I thought it would be actually lower than that. I've worked on the enterprise side for a long time. I've done consulting, like I said, for the past 5 years. And what I've seen is a very, very low percentage of nefarious use cases for insider threats. A lot of times when you're putting an insider threat program in place, you're really focusing on the accidental data loss and the accidental threats that come along with insiders that aren't educated to handle data safely, or the security mechanisms aren't in place to act as a safety net for that data. So insider threats, they do exist, and we've seen it with data breaches. But I think that in normal cases, a high percentage is looking at that accidental data loss and not necessarily malicious action.
What happens when people focus on malicious action and not these other kind of everyday things?
When they focus on malicious action and not the everyday thing, I mean, it's good to focus on that and be aware that that's something that could happen. You know, I think it comes down to being able to tune your tools and your policies in a way where it's focusing on both, because I think both are very important to identify. I don't know which one I would say is more critical, honestly, because you have your employees, and if they're in a workflow where they're exfiltrating data, that's an insider threat. And they could be running this workflow for, you know, years and years before you can identify it. When that malicious actor comes along and they're leaving to go to a new job and they want to exfiltrate, you know, data to their house, you know, you're not often going to see them exfiltrating credit card numbers and then using those credit card numbers. It does happen, and it is a threat. But I would say that the other is more of a common scenario from my experience.
Right. It's kind of that low hanging fruit, the stuff that doesn't get your attention. And then if someone is trying to exfiltrate data, they're smart enough to know to do it in ways that don't raise eyebrows. It's not like a movie, right? Where someone has a thumb drive, maybe they're going to download 10,000 gigabytes of stuff, you know, overnight. Right. Like it just doesn't happen that way, you know? So,
and there's ways to get around that, which we're not going to go into.
Right.
There's ways around to get around DLP and controls that we're not going to get into, but you know, if someone is going to the length to be doing that, you would think that they put some research into it or what have you. And again, you know, it's the accidental data loss, the exfiltration, the, you know, process improvement side of things that I think really needs to be looked at with these tools and then changes made and consistently tested against.
What do you think? What do you see when you're consulting or you're talking with companies? What do you see in terms of the low-hanging fruit that you say, oh my God, like you're concerned about all these other crazy, wacky, you know, rare things, and then here's kind of a major basic thing that probably maybe is kind of low-tech or no-tech thing that a company can do? What are your thoughts about that?
When you're talking about false positives, like false positives, you can look at, and it could just be a string of numbers in a URL that match a credit card. Those you have to eliminate. Those are just policies and rules you need to eliminate. The actual data exfiltration that insiders are performing, you know, it could be shortcuts. It could be, you know, I don't have enough time in a day. Let me send this to my Dropbox at home. Now that you're working at home, a lot of people are working remote. It's exfiltrating data from your corporate network to your home network. And that could get flagged. It could be, you know, writing data to a disk or a USB drive to be able to take that with you mobile or hand that to someone else that you need to collaborate with. I mean, typically they're all workflows that have some type of justification to it. But then once you identify that, that's when it comes down to the education piece and the policy improvement and being able to eliminate these workflows and educate the user, because then you bring in these other solutions like you have, you know, encrypted drives or you have other safeguards in place that you need to educate a user on. Say, you don't do it this way. You do it this way. This is how we prefer you to do it. And now it's policy that you do it. We've uncovered this rogue workflow. Now we're going to put this policy in place to fix that. So it's those type of, I think, workflow shortcuts that I see the most that need to be eliminated. Because I don't think that they know. You know, they don't know. They don't know the danger that they're posing to the organization and to themselves. And once you educate them there, then I think that, you know, the goal is to have the controls in place, but also have their mind thinking in a different way.
That's great. That's great advice. That's something that all companies need to really think about. I want your thoughts on shadow IT. So I had the pleasure of being on a conference panel many years ago, and there were some people who weren't, these are not technical folks, right? They're in a different industry. And they were talking about how great shadow IT was. So, hey, you know, maybe IT doesn't give us the tools we need. We can go out and get what we want. And I'm cringing listening to people say this. It's like horrible. And then, you know, I think shadow IT has always been a problem.
Wait, who was saying that? The user or the organization?
The organization. Customers of the organization.
Okay. I can see that.
Yes. Because it benefits them, right? Oh, you know, I don't want to use, you know, this is a great example. So I was consulting with a company. They were using a certain like Box or Dropbox or something. And then we switched them to a better tool that was more secure, you know, not, you know, something that we tested and we could handle better. And this other person just had a fit because they were accustomed to doing their workflow that way and that tool. And they didn't really understand why that wasn't like the most secure thing. And also it wasn't like a sanctioned application by, you know, the organization. But I think shadow IT was always a problem because you have people doing things differently and data in places that the IT or the cyber folks are not aware of. But I think the cloud added just more complication because it's easy now for people to go in and sign up for an account and upload data to a cloud account and no one knows anything about it. Like I heard someone tell me once that they had, I guess they were using some cloud application within the organization, and the guy who created the account, he left the company. And then when he left the company, he stopped paying for the thing, and all their stuff got deleted, and people didn't know that it wasn't, you know, an application that was sanctioned by the company and it wasn't paid by the company. So it was like a huge mess. But I say all that to say, I would love your thoughts on kind of shadow IT and the things that people don't understand why it's a problem.
Yeah, so I don't think shadow IT is ever going away, because even if you have it locked down, people are going to try to get those applications, those non-sanctioned applications. So I think when you're looking at shadow IT, I think there's really three main aspects I would look at. And one is discovery. So understand what applications exist. Cloud apps exist. So whether you're using a CASB or some other type of discovery tool, make sure that you're scanning and understanding what the shadow IT landscape looks like. And then understand the use cases for those applications. So if it is Dropbox and you don't allow it, then understand the reason for that. Are they using it for home use? Are they using it for work use? And then potentially implement a enterprise solution to, you know, help with that use case versus allowing the user to go out and use these rogue applications? And then the last one I would say is controlling those applications. So if there's applications in Shadow IT that you know you don't want a user to access, lock those down. And, you know, block list applications you don't want users using. And then, you know, within that tool, you can also do auditing and other type of metrics. But, you know, those are the things that, and it is a risk. It's definitely a risk. And yeah, I think those are the three ways that I would suggest an organization take a closer look at it.
Yeah, that's great. I would love your thoughts on kind of how cyber and what you do intersect with privacy. So privacy, I always tell people privacy, you know, existed before our computers, right? So we're trying to protect people's rights, but it's becoming, as we're in a more data age and a technology age, you know, privacy is coming more to the forefront, and it gets, you know, intertangled and interwoven into conversations around cyber. So tell me about your experience with privacy and how it kind of intersects or intertwines with what you do in cybersecurity.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, I think, you know, one thing that I think of now is the data security and metaverse. I think that's top of mind for me. Anytime that you're talking about data, you have data ownership and your personal data is attached to it, or someone's personal data is attached to it. And then once you have that, you know, that could be used against you in identity theft and many other ways. So top of mind for me right now is the metaverse and what's coming with the metaverse, and the privacy implications there. And I'm not a huge Marvel fan, like, you know, Spider-Man and Hulk, but in the Marvel universe, there's something called a multiverse, which I think is a collection of these alternate universes, which share a universal hierarchy. So when I think of metaverse and privacy, you know, that's my perspective, that is that you have all these mix of universes, it blends together, everybody's data is out there. You know, how is it secured? How are people's data and privacy secured? And it blurs the lines of reality for me, and to others as well. So if you talk about data and privacy, and if your reality is skewed within these multiverses, how do you know who to trust, what to trust, and where to trust when you're distributing that data that ties to your privacy? So again, I think it's always been, you know, chained together in a way where it's data and privacy, but I think the metaverse is just going to take that to a whole nother level.
I agree with that. I think people don't really, you know, I end up working or advising people in those emerging technology areas, you know, virtual reality, augmented reality, mixed reality, and different types of applications. So I think when people in the news, when you see articles, they're talking about metaverse as kind of a consumer product, almost like what a gamer would use or whatever. But what I'm seeing is real applications in kind of training, like training simulations, education, tons of stuff in medical, you know, that, you know, these are real things that are happening. So I think, you know, we should be concerned, and I am concerned. That's why I got involved in this, because once you start to capture, you're basically capturing things that no one ever captured before. So, you know, it raises the stakes, it raises the risk in terms of what's being collected and then what is happening with that data. Like, is this data really truly to benefit the individual? How do we kind of limit that data retention? How do you limit that data sharing? Do people even know what they're sharing, or you know, right, what they're agreeing to? And a lot of, when I'm working a lot with people in these applications, we came up with this thing. Well, I call it like incremental consent, because there, I think there's going to be a situation where you're, you know, if you're in, like, if you're wearing VR glasses, or you're in sort of an augmented space that has like sensors and stuff like that, based on what you do, you may have to give consent like through that journey. So that's like a different, that's different than you know, checking the Xbox, a tick box when you're on some privacy policy or something. It's like, based on what you do, you may need certain types of consent, I guess.
Yeah, and I think as the metaverse becomes more adopted and more universal, you're going to start seeing more of those types of digital transactions on digital goods. That's a risk, you know. And back to the glasses piece, if we're all avatars, you know, and we're walking around with these glasses, we're going to see avatars. Are they real? Are they not real? Are you exchanging your phone number with an avatar or someone real? Like and I'm talking like way down the line, but these are the things that I think of. You know, if your digital avatar that you have in the metaverse and you're playing a game, if that's comprised of code, if that's comprised of ones and zeros, and that code is compromised or cloned, you know, then what you have walking around is an evil twin. It's an evil clone of yourself. So that's identity theft right there. That's identity theft in the metaverse. So, you know, that becomes very dangerous. And again, as this tech becomes more open and distributable, how do we fix that? You know, how do we secure that? And those are the things that in terms of privacy, I think down the line, we need to start looking at now. And I think maybe, you know, it could be MFA. It could be a way in MFA, because I think with MFA, it separates the real world from the metaverse. So you could have third party app validation. You could have metaverse merchant validation, right? If you're going, if you're transacting goods, you know, have it, you know, a secure verified vendor, have a physical device to be able to authorize that. So you don't, you know, you're forced to have that physical device. I don't know. There's a lot of things to think, a lot of things to think about when it comes to that and privacy. But, and another thing is government. Like, do we have a government? You heard about the metaverse story where a woman was assaulted in the metaverse, you know, and I talked about this before. Do you go to court in real life? Do you go to court in the metaverse? What are your repercussions? So I think there has to be some type of government around that. And I think it's just too early on to realize that. But I think that's where the privacy experts need to get involved.
Yeah, I agree with that. What's your thoughts? So the metaverse for some people may be far off into the future. I don't agree. But I would love something that's here now that I love your thoughts on is kind of like IoT devices. So my friends in cyber who work in either municipalities or private companies, they're going bananas about IoT. The devices that people want to put on networks, and just the fact that, you know, right now it's kind of a very Wild West type of thing. So I tell people like IoT device is like a computer without a screen. So, you know, you don't really know what exactly it's doing. You know, you hope it's doing what you think it is. You don't know what, you know, if it's connected to the internet. You know, there are just so many variables there in terms of security. But also I saw a statistic, very eye-opening. They said that most companies have more IoT devices than computers connected to their network. So it's like, you know, it's kind of a threat that people aren't really talking about as much. And I think that they should. But what are your thoughts about that IoT?
Yeah, so that stat that you saw, is that, that stat was for the enterprise, like within organizations, they have the IoT devices?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, on the consumer side, I stay away from IoT. I try to stay away from IoT. The scary part is the devices that you have in your home that are IoT that you don't know are IoT, that have access, like your TV. It's collecting that data. Sometimes it has, you know, a mic on the remote that you need to disable manually, that's calling out, you know, those are the type of devices that scare me, that the consumers aren't aware of. If they are aware of it, you know, I think that's where the education comes in terms of what data are they collecting. And I don't think that consumers are quite clear on that. And if they are, then I think they need to understand the risk that they're up against. In the organization, yeah, you're right. I mean, IoT is taking over, especially when you're talking about industrial industries or manufacturing industries. And I don't think that we can rely on the manufacturers Like, we cannot rely on the manufacturers to secure these devices. I think that as an organization, we need to understand every device that is connected and what it's doing and secure it properly, whether that's segmentation, whether that's, you know, validation. I think that we need to have, and that goes back to the visibility. Like, we have to have visibility what's on our network and understand what we're connecting to. So yeah, that's my take on IoT. I personally don't do IoT too much. And then from the organization side, again, just know what you're plugging in, make sure you do the validation, make sure you do the testing, like it is a PC, and understand the threat there.
That's good advice for people.
I'm not an IoT expert, Debbie.
Like,
you know, that's just from my experience.
I work with companies on IoT devices, and I'm like you, I don't have IoT devices in my house either, because I prefer not to invite surveillance into my home if I can help it. Right.
You don't know who's behind that. Like,
right.
You don't know who's, you know, altering your perspective on things. And that's what scares me, is that you have a perspective, but then those IoT devices could influence you. And, you know, that's scary.
Oh, absolutely. I don't know. And that's not far-fetched, right? So think of it like the Netflix meme. So I have, frankly, two different profiles on Netflix. And believe it or not, one has a man's name, one has a woman's name, and I see different things. It's crazy. Really? Yes, totally bananas. So part of what I try to fight against is I want to see things unfiltered, right? I don't want things to be pre-filtered before I decide kind of what's drilled down. So I think the way the internet is, people sort of assume that we see the same thing. So based on where we are and what these algorithms think that we want to see, we're only seeing kind of a portion of things. So having IoT devices, maybe they're trying to think of it as personalization, but it's really sort of limiting your choices in some ways.
It is. And again, we've talked about this before. When you're talking about IoT and limiting choices, it's using an algorithm in the back end, an AI algorithm that's looking at your viewing behavior, right? You know, as a human, that could change overnight. Like, your decision making can change overnight. You could have a life changing event that changes your perspective on what you want to watch that night. And I don't think there's any way that you can accurately predict that. And it's just, you know, it's crazy. And I don't know if we're ever going to get to that point where it's 100% accurate, or if I want it to be 100% accurate, to be honest with you.
When you see these data breaches, I don't know. I would love your thoughts about this. So a lot of times in the news, like you say, data breaches are going mainstream. So you're seeing the news every day about some new data breach to happen with some big company. Do you feel like sometimes some maybe small to medium businesses, when they see this, they think it could not possibly happen to them because they're not, you know, Sony or they're not Target or something? What are your thoughts about that?
100%. I know that they're thinking that, because a lot of the folks that I consult with are SMBs and small business owners. And, you know, a new term that a friend of mine, Jim Tiller, has coined, in the shadows. These companies and these SMBs are in the shadows right now. They used to be, you know, behind these big corporations and nobody's looking at them. But now with the digital transformation piece, the supply chain workflows, you know, they're dealing with these big corporations, whether they know it or not, behind the scenes. So they're affected, I think, more than ever right now. And in addition, they don't typically have the security controls stood up like a Fortune 500 company would, or have the resources or staff to be able to look at and monitor attacks. So that's an easy target for attackers. And so, yes, they definitely need to think about that. And it's, again, you've heard it a million times, but it's a matter of when, not if.
And tell me a little bit about educating people about looking at cybersecurity as more of a risk-based exercise as opposed to kind of a reaction. So being proactive as opposed to being reactive. Because I feel like the way people have been trained is like, okay, we don't need, these tech people around, we know what to do until something bad happens and we sort of call them in. They're supposed to rescue us some kind of way. But the issue that most companies have, especially around breaches or ransomware, things like that, is that you have to have a plan in place. You have to have a system in place. You have to kind of think thoughtfully about cybersecurity and how you're protecting your data before you get into kind of an emergency situation. So tell me a little bit about how you advise companies who maybe think, okay, we don't really need cyber unless like something bad happens. So I feel like people treat cybersecurity almost like it's, you're the fire department. So it's like, Okay, let's, we don't need you until something bad happens, then we'll call you. And then all of a sudden you're supposed to like, sweep in and like rescue folks.
Right. Yeah. Then you got to show them the stats of like, this is what happens when you think like that. These are the companies that are getting breached and getting hit with that mindset. So, it really depends on how mature the organization is. You got to look at what your IR plan looks like, what your IR processes are. I'm a big proponent of performing crisis simulation or tabletop type exercises to plan for this type of event. You can do that on any scale. You can do that on any level, whether you're 5 employees or 5,000 employees or 55,000 employees. There's different ways that you can go about training on how to properly react to those type of situations and identify those situations and see them coming. So definitely practice crisis simulation. Definitely take a look at your IR and your disaster recovery plans. Make sure that you have backups in place. There's a lot of simple and free actions that you can take as an organization to prepare for an attack and then react to one once that happens. And I think a lot of SMBs and smaller organizations don't know that. There's very, very simple MFA. MFA is the number one aspect on defense that I recommend, which is low cost. And, it's not the silver bullet, but it will save you. So things like that, password managers, enforcing strong password policies. I mean, these are very high level things that can prevent against these attacks that SMBs and smaller businesses just need to be aware of how to implement.
Yeah, I think the idea is to not be the lowest hanging fruit, because I think that attackers, they look for the easiest target, the easiest way in. So you don't want to be that easy target. You don't want to be that easy way in. So if you have something, even though multi-factor authentication, MFA, isn't like a silver bullet and won't save you in all instances, if an attacker is looking at, say 10 different companies, and 8 of them have MFA, he's going to go for those other 2 that don't have it, right? Because those are going to be those easy targets.
It's like a car thief. They're going to go down the street, check the doors. And if your door is locked, that doesn't mean they can't break in. They're just not going to waste their effort. They're going to go to the next one to see if that door is unlocked. So it's almost very similar in that sense, where you do what you can, and these easy controls that you can implement, you have to implement. So I think that SMBs and these smaller organizations just need to be aware of those things and to help better protect themselves, because they are at risk and sensitive data resides there, and they just have to protect themselves and their customers.
Yeah. Excellent. So, Chris, if we're the world according to you and we did everything you said, what would be your wish for privacy, cybersecurity, data protection, anywhere in the world or in any facet, whether it be technology, human stuff? What are your thoughts?
I mean, my wish, even though I don't see it happening, is that we can just kill off ransomware, because I think ransomware is probably the number one threat to organizations today. And I think that we have a lot of controls and mechanisms in place to help detect it and help identify it. But I don't see a way of stopping that anytime soon. So if I had a wish, I would wish that there was a solution to stop it, kill it tomorrow. That would be my wish. That's so if anyone out there has that formula, please call me. Let's talk.
That's a very good wish. That's a very good wish. I feel like part of the problem with ransomware is kind of psychological in a way, with people. So it's like, you know, let's say you have five businesses on a block, right? This ransomware person can attack all five, and chances are they're not going to talk to these businesses aren't going to talk to each other. So let's say someone had a ransomware attack. They tend to not want to talk or not want to share what they learned, right? So then this trick, everyone else falls for the same trick because there isn't kind of that knowledge sharing or someone saying, hey, you know, you should watch out because this happened to me, or, you know, here's what we learned from this attack. It's kind of like, let's like not say anything because I'm afraid to get sued. And then the same thing happens over and over. So, you know, the ransomware folks are having like a field day because that this same trick they can play over and over and over again, and people fall for it over and over because there just isn't enough, you know, information there to help people really protect themselves.
Yeah. 100%. And I think understanding and everybody puts so much stress on the human factor and being able to recognize a phishing attack, because phishing attack is the number one attack vector for ransomware, and just being able to train the human. But I think, you know, the human is always going to make mistakes. That link is always going to get clicked. So we need to have a mechanism in place to stop ransomware. And, yeah, I think we need the answer for that, or at least mitigate it. And I think, like what you said, being able to share those experiences will help us get there. But, you know, we have to be communicating with each other to be able to do that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for doing the show. This was great. Definitely, I would love for people to tune in. Definitely subscribe to your the Barcode podcast. I think you guys are your People's Choice Podcast Award winners, I believe. It's a great show, and I learned so much. And you really, for people who want to get down and deep, you know, not on the surface level on some of these topics with your guests, you definitely go there, which is great because it's a great education for all of us. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Debbie. And thank you for having me on your show. We'll have to have you come back at some point. And we'd love to have you. You know, you're a VIP patron at the Barcode. So anytime you want to come through, grab a Divatini, you just let me know.
That's right. The Divatini is amazing.
thank you so much. Yeah, definitely. And we'll catch up in real life one time and have a real one.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Talk to you soon. Bye.